Ready for that? There was no response. Until several minutes later. Joshua had thought it out. Was all of this just an accident of fate? His being here in a jail cell in Tehran, next to an Iranian pastor who was talking to him about the Christian gospel? It seemed as though, in some strange way, for him, it had to be in a place like this, on a concrete floor spotted with filth, blood, and cockroaches. Though he didn't know why exactly. Somehow it just fit. For Joshua, the time for avoidance had ceased. A voice came out of Joshua's cell. "Okay. Let's go. Right now? Yeah, now." "I have questions for you," Dr. Abdu said. "I'm ready."
"Do you believe that you're a sinner, Joshua? That you have broken God's laws, are guilty of sin, and separated from God as a result?"
"That I've offended God? That's a no-brainer." "Odd. Never admitted that out loud before."
"Do you repent of your sins? And do you want to receive forgiveness for them? Do you want to come into a relationship with the living God?"
"Hermos, truth be told, I've tried to keep this a secret. Tried to keep it screwed on tight."
"Secret?"
"Tried hard to succeed at the externals in my life. Military career, professional life. But the inside of me, a pretty dark, lonely, restless place, is a mess. Morally, spiritually, and every other way. I think God's the only one who can fix it."
"Then do you accept the work of Jesus Christ on the cross, the Son of God, who was the only, once and for all, perfect sacrifice for your sins, and who then walked out of that grave 3 days later?"
"I accept that. I believe that. As God is my witness, I do."
"Do you invite Jesus the Christ to come and live inside you through the Spirit of God and to be your Savior and your Lord?"
But Joshua's voice stopped at that point. There was weeping somewhere, until Joshua realized that the tears were his own. His face was against the cold steel bars, bowed and broken, cornered and isolated, faced with the most important decision he would ever make, in a forsaken place of torture. A jail cell that smelled of urine, a place of heartless cruelty. But one thought surfaced. This place, it reminded him of something else. The place of the cross, where Jesus paid the price for him. Crucifixion. He had known it abstractly, but now it was much more than that. As if he was standing before the crude, bloody cross of Christ. Now it finally seemed to make sense to him, that a place of horror and cruelty could also become the source of all that is good and true. So too this jail cell could be the right place at the right time for something miraculously good to happen. Joshua's words were hardly perceptible. "Jesus, come into me, my Savior. Oh God." Joshua tried to hold back the tears but couldn't. Then there were no more words. Until another voice came out of the darkness from another cell, from another prisoner.
"Dr. Abdu?"
"Yes?"
"Please, may I pray that prayer to Jesus too?"
Chapter 54. At the Bushehr nuclear launch facility in Iran, the pre-launch was completed. The tops of the three missile silos, all in a row, opened like the eyes of a triple-eyed dragon. The warning siren was wailing, and the warning lights on each silo were flashing. The three Qiyam missiles had been tested. Their accuracy was absolute. Thanks to Russian engineering assistance, the formerly outdated short-range missiles were now long-range, and at speeds of more than Mach 3, they would outfly the Israeli jet fighters that would try to intercept them. More importantly, each had a new radar system that would send deflecting countermeasures to ward off defensive Israeli ground-to-air missiles. The three weapons officers, each at the launch panel, listened to the countdown. Then, with a deadly choreography of hands, they simultaneously reached forward and pushed the green buttons on the panels in front of them. Smoke and fire blew out of the silos as the three nuclear missiles hurtled into the air and onto their trajectories, streaking toward Tel Aviv, Haifa, and Galilee. Inside IDF headquarters, where they had verified the launch of the Iranian missiles, Israel's military chief bowed his head with his staff. This was the moment of truth. They prayed the prayers of Nila. Even though the calendar told them this was not yet the Day of Atonement, the impending threat of annihilation told them that it was. The order was given at IDF headquarters to launch three separate defensive return-to-sender-equipped missiles. They would come from sites as far south as the Judean Desert to a base in the far north at Katsrin along the Golan. IDF radar had picked up the first Iranian nuke heading on a course that looked as if it was in the direction of Tiberias in Galilee. At Katsrin, the first defensive missile blew out of its silo. It was armed with a refashioned Israeli version of the return-to-sender laser system. The trio of Iranian nuclear warheads flashed over Jordan and neared Israeli airspace. The IDF had already scrambled several F-15s into the air when the intel alerted them of a potential attack. But that didn't seem to matter. They tried to hit the Qiyam missiles with defensive warheads of their own over Jordan airspace, but the effort was fruitless. The missiles flashed by with blinding speed. Israeli ground-to-air defenses were launched along the Jordan River, sending up a raft of Patriot missiles. But the newly engineered Qiyam guidance system had automatic countermeasures built in, along with a frighteningly accurate missile avoidance system. The nukes were untouched. Still on course, they were heading for Tel Aviv, Haifa, and Tiberias on the Sea of Galilee. Tiberias was the closest. It would get hit first. Amid the sound of ear-piercing sirens, thousands of screaming tourists piled into buses, attempting to flee the city along the famous sea. But for them, there would be no time for escape if the nuclear warhead hit its mark. The rows of hotels and houses would be incinerated all the way around the coast up to Taba. The blast would level everything in the area, including the ancient city of Capernaum, where Jesus had taught in the synagogue and had settled during his initial ministry. It would all be gone, along with the Sea of Galilee itself. The nuclear fireball would instantly evaporate the water. The Iranian nuclear warhead was streaking toward the outer border of the Sea of Galilee. At IDF command, they stared at their radar screen. A gut-wrenching thought was right there in front of them. Their RTS-armed missile might not be able to intercept the incoming nuke in time. They had done the logistics with Joshua Jordan. There was a minimum angle of encounter required between the laser beam shot from their RTS missile and the nose cone of the incoming nuclear warhead. Their RTS had been fired down from the north, 30 miles away from the projected intersection point with the Iranian nuke. But at the calculated speed of the Iranian missile, the required intercept might not happen. The staff at IDF headquarters could see that now. The Iranian nuke might blow right past their RTS missile and hit Tiberias. Meanwhile, an RTS missile from a site in central Israel was in the air, closing in on the Iranian Qiyam rocket heading toward Tel Aviv. To protect Haifa, an RTS missile had been launched from the Jezreel Valley to intercept that nuclear warhead. The IDF staff watched the screen. The blinking cursor of the Iranian nuke heading toward Galilee. The other blinking dot, their RTS missile heading toward the nuclear missile at an oblique angle. No one was breathing. It would take only seconds to learn their fate, but the clock seemed to stand still. 2 miles up, the incoming RTS was 1,000 feet from the Iranian nuke. But it was heading at an extreme angle. The RTS intercept was not designed to work at that kind of approach. The laser blasted out from the RTS missile and struck the side of the nose cone of the Qiyam missile where the guidance system was housed. But the nose cone of the nuke had also been protected by a Russian anti-laser shield. That was something that the Israelis had prepared for. Their Mossad agents had wiretapped the conversations of Iranian nuclear engineers, so they had upped the capacity of Joshua Jordan's laser. They hoped it could penetrate the Russian-made shield. The RTS laser beam entered the guidance program of the Qiyam nuke from the side. The data stream from the laser did a light-speed mirror reversal of the trajectory. The Iranian nuke did a slow U-turn and started back toward its place of origin. But the Iranian missile had experienced a slow fuel leakage. It would never find its way home. Instead, it would land along the border of Jordan and Syria, without detonating. The missiles heading for Tel Aviv and Haifa were encountered dead-on by the outgoing RTS defensive missiles. Perfect laser contact was made with the onboard guidance systems in the nuclear warheads. The nukes swung around in an arc and headed back to their launch site. At IDF headquarters, they saw it all on radar. There was a burst of screaming and cheers and backslapping and weeping. A few of the younger officers hopped onto the tables and bellowed at the top of their lungs. Iranian command in Bushehr was tracking the missiles. The officers saw what was happening. They sprinted from their posts and madly scrambled to escape the port city before the devastation hit. They were too hysterical to appreciate the irony. They would have no problem with traffic, because the Iranian government, not trusting the local population, had already evacuated the city's 200,000 residents 2 months before the launch, suspicious of sabotage. The city was now a ghost town of empty homes and stores, all except for the members of the Iranian nuclear project. Now they were careening around corners at 70 miles an hour in their Mercedes-Benzes, trying to escape, but in vain. The second nuke that had been intended for Haifa would hit Bushehr first. There was a blinding light. The iridescent cloud expanded over the city, followed by a wave of sonic force and a solar inferno that swept out in a circumference of obliteration that melted down to black glass and ash the entire Iranian nuclear facility, as well as the nuclear enrichment building and the launch silos. The second nuclear detonation came from the second missile only a minute later. The twin mushroom clouds rose 10 miles into the sky. When it cleared, the only thing left of the nuclear facility and the surrounding city was a few gnarled pipes sticking out of the ground, a single cement wall, and the reinforced girders of a dozen former office buildings that now jutted out like mangled steel skeletons. When the news reached President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, he was in his palace, surrounded by his advisors. His aides were silent, eyeing each other. Then the president exploded into an uncontrollable rant. Even at his age, he had the energy to do that well. Ahmadinejad, his face contorted with rage, balled up his fists and swung them into the air like a boxer who could not find his opponent. "How can my nuclear dream be destroyed? Gone! Gone!" While he was cursing the destruction of Bushehr, somewhere 200,000 Iranians were quietly celebrating the fact that they had been forced to move out of their homes and shops in Bushehr because of Ahmadinejad's paranoia. He had, inadvertently, saved them all from destruction. As the sun began setting over Iran, Ahmadinejad, in his mad fury, cursed the day. John Gallagher and his makeshift assault crew had dug in at their positions in the woods in the Shenandoah Valley. They had a good view of the metal barn. Now they were swatting bugs and waiting. Then there was some movement. A man, unarmed, left the barn and walked over to a car. He started it up and walked back to the barn. A few minutes later, the big barn doors swung open. A cart with a crate on top, slightly larger than a refrigerator, was rolled out by four men. They gingerly slid the crate off the cart and into the back of the truck. Then one of the men stayed in the back of the truck. Gallagher thought that he was hooking something up, maybe a remote detonating device. Then the man in the truck jumped out and locked the back doors. Two men with clip-loaded automatics exited the barn, and they handed an extra one to him. A fourth man appeared. He was also armed. One of the men turned back, as if to re-enter the barn, perhaps to close the doors. Deputy Colwyn's voice came over the bullhorn. "This is the sheriff's department. Drop your weapons immediately. Drop them." Then the 2 second count. 1,001, 1,002. The men by the barn froze. They lifted their weapons, trying to figure out where the warning had come from. Gallagher gave Dumpster the signal. There was a chest-punching boom from Dumpster's 50 caliber that echoed through the valley. The gunman closest to him dropped as if pulled by an invisible cord. The two gunmen closest to Dumpster saw the flash. Dumpster quickly squeezed off another shot, winging one of the men in the leg and causing him to drop his weapon momentarily. The other gunman yelled out wildly and scattered automatic fire through the woods, back and forth in the direction of Dumpster and Gallagher. Gallagher unloaded his .357 toward the gunman, but he was moving as he was returning fire, and then skirted around the truck. Don't shoot at the back of the truck, Gallagher told himself. Blackie's shotgun was blasting from the other side of the clearing, along with the sound of shots being fired by Frank Trumeth and Deputy Colwyn. In the melee, the gunman, injured in the leg by dumpster, had crawled under the truck and was clawing his way to the cab. Gallagher tried to get a clear shot at him, but couldn't. He yelled to Dumpster, "You okay, Dumpster?" Gallagher thought he heard groaning coming from Dumpster's position. More shots on the other side of the truck, on his blind side. Then a final furious volley of shots. Gallagher was trying to figure it out quickly. One bad guy down, probably dead. Another injured and under the truck. A third, apparently not hit, was on the other side of the truck somewhere. Where's the fourth guy? The answer came. The fourth gunman popped up from his position, crouching under the truck engine, and he frantically opened the cab door and swung himself inside the truck. Then he geared it forward. Gallagher reloaded and blasted several rounds from his .357 into the door as it roared past. He couldn't tell if his shots had found their mark. Gallagher could see three dead terrorists on the ground. The fourth was driving a truck armed with a nuclear device down the gravel road. Gallagher took off running after the truck, thinking that it might have to slow down at the security gate. He was panting and out of shape, but he kept running. He could see the truck up ahead racing down the dirt road, spitting gravel and dirt. Then something popped out of the woods in front of the truck. It was Ruby with her Remington shotgun. She fired once into the windshield from her shoulder. The truck kept coming. She pumped it with jackhammer speed and fired again, this time from the hip, again into the windshield. The truck slowed, swerved slightly, and then rolled to a stop with the front end in the underbrush. Gallagher ran up, yelling to Ruby to stay clear of the truck. "Great shooting, Ruby! Wow, you're incredible! I married the wrong woman! Listen, I think Dumpster was hit. Go find him back there and help him." Gallagher, holding his handgun, swung the truck door open. The mess inside of the cab told him immediately that the threat was over. By the time Ruby reached Dumpster, Blackie was there. Their all phones were working again, and they called for an EMT and the sheriff's department to come. Dumpster had been hit in the clavicle and he was squirming in pain. But in between groans, while they tried to stop the bleeding, he kept saying, "We got him! We got him! We got him!" Frank Trumeth and Gallagher slowly opened the back of the truck and turned on the overhead dome light. Several thick cables ran from the crate into the cab of the truck. They lifted the top off and looked in. "Ever seen one of these?" Frank asked as they surveyed the compact nuclear bomb. "Only in pictures," Gallagher said. Then he added, "How about we put the top back on, okay?" In Union Beach, the truck with the Mexican food markings on its side was still parked in front of the machine shop, fully loaded. Several of the men were milling around. The assault team had picked up their conversation through their listening device, so they knew they had automatic weapons underneath their jackets. The three-man assault team and the black SUV now had to intercept the truck. The driver slammed the vehicle into gear and sped toward the machine shop, two blocks away. They had to round the large sewage treatment facility to get there. Inexplicably, a parade of seven septic trucks from the local community had chosen the night hours to pull into the access lane leading to the sewage plant, lining up to unload at the site, two abreast. They were blocking the access road in both directions. The driver of the special ops team blasted his horn. He shouted for them to get out of the way. The septic truck driver stuck his head out the window and shouted back a few profanities. The team could see off in the distance that the truck with the nuke was leaving the parking lot of the machine shop. It stopped momentarily and then turned onto the street. It was on a road parallel to the access road by the sewage plant about 100 yards away. The driver of the SUV immediately saw that they had only one option. The three men grabbed their weapons, jumped from the car, and sprinted through the gate in the chain-link fence that cordoned their SUV from the other street. Their legs were windmills as they ran furiously across the grassy grounds of the sewage plant and toward the truck. They knew that they were now in plain sight, but they also knew that if they did not stop this truck, it would get into Manhattan and destroy New York City and a whole lot of its inhabitants. The truck, which had been rolling about 15 miles per hour, now sped up quickly. Two men were in the front cab, and two were out of sight in the back. The driver glanced over at the three men sprinting toward the truck, who were now about 30 yards away. The lead man from the assault team gave the command, "Drop and fire!" The three men hit the ground and began firing, two at the tires and one at the driver. The driver fell forward and then was pulled down by his passenger, who took over the wheel. The tires were flattened. The truck was slowing and rumbling loudly as it rolled forward, shuddering on shredded rubber. The three men jumped to their feet and raced furiously toward the truck, shooting as they ran. But the man behind the wheel had his eyes opened so wildly they could see the whites from their running position. The man in the truck mouthed something. Then he reached under the dashboard. One of the special ops men saw it as he ran. It was his last utterance. "Oh my God, no!" Then the blinding flash, and the nuclear fireball from the small nuclear device. Heat as if from an exploding star incinerated everything in its blast radius, vaporizing much of Union Beach and those residents who had not commuted out of the small town to work. The blast spread outward in a horrific wave of decimation. It started fires in the adjoining towns. Several miles away, the cars that were traveling on the Garden State Parkway were rolled over by the force of the blast. The sonic explosion whipped the harbor into 10-foot waves, which plowed across the lower New York Bay and battered the opposite coast of New York. To the north, the blast was heard through New York City and shook the pavement and rocked office buildings. Electric grids were overloaded, shutting down traffic lights and darkening the marquees and jumbo screens that were usually blazing along Times Square. Pedestrians on the sidewalks of New York screamed when they saw it. The nightmare vision of a nuclear mushroom cloud rising into the sky across the bay, over in New Jersey. A few miles from Union Beach, Jim Yanicki had been waiting in his Hummer for a report from his three fellow special ops contractors. It would never come. Instead, the blast blew out his windows and rolled his big car over on its side. He was temporarily knocked unconscious. When he came to, he climbed straight up out of his tipped-over Hummer through the passenger door. He staggered to his feet. Buildings were on fire around him, and cars were scattered as if a tornado had just swept through the area. He felt a powerful easterly wind blowing. But amidst the nuclear horror, he didn't calculate the small blessing in that. How could he? The wind was blowing the radioactive cloud out to sea, rather than north into the heart of Manhattan. Chapter 55. In Tehran, the crowds spilled onto the streets. The news had spread that Bushehr had been decimated in some kind of nuclear explosion, but the government had promptly cut all of the internet service for its citizens to try to contain the news of its embarrassing defeat. Rumors spread wildly. Iranians were hearing some theories that Bushehr had been incinerated during a nuclear mishap caused by the Iranian scientists. Was it another Chernobyl? They didn't know. Most of the rioters in the streets didn't care. They were now even doubting the reports of a supposed Israeli attack against Natanz. They had missed their opportunity to topple their own tyrant during the Middle East upheavals of 2011, when the citizens of other nations in the region were overthrowing dictators. This was finally their chance. They had grown weary listening to the eccentric lies of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad for more than two decades, while the people starved or were arrested by the secret police or worse. They had had enough. The crowds in the streets numbered nearly 30,000. The Iranian army was ordered to quell the protest, but half of the enlisted men refused to respond to the order. They quietly decided that they would no longer serve in a military headed up by a lunatic. In the middle of the protest were 90 members of the CDCI, the Committee for Democratic Change in Iran. Yosef Abbas was striding next to his friend, whose apartment had been serving as his safe house. "Over there," Yosef announced and pointed to a forlorn-looking two-story warehouse. "That is where they are keeping the political prisoners." His friend touched something under his belt, covered by his shirt, making sure his revolver was still there. He turned to Yosef. "You are sure this is the special prison?" Yosef nodded. His contact in the Israeli Mossad had told him they had irrefutable intelligence about the prison. Yosef had been promised safe passage to Israel. He didn't want that. All he cared about was the release of his brother and sister, and to get that done he would have to do this one last thing: encourage the CDCI to stage a raid on the prison that housed political dissidents. It also happened to house the real target of the rescue, Joshua Jordan. None of the Iranians realized that this was the same strategy used by Colonel Bull Simmons back in 1979 when he rescued Ross Perot's EDS employees from a Tehran jail. It was Rocky Bridger who had borrowed that page from Simmons's playbook when he laid out the rescue plan for the Israelis. In the street, Yosef's friend signaled to his group leaders. Then he said to Yosef,
"You realize the Iranian MOIS will now put you on the list
because you are part of the CDCI. No turning back." There was a funny look on Yosef's face as he nodded. His friend could not possibly have known that Yosef was already an enemy of the state, beyond anything the CDCI could imagine. Over 60 of the CDCI were armed as they stormed the warehouse prison. They broke down the front door and fired shots in the air. There was no resistance, at least at first. Some of the dozen jailers for the 10 prisoners had already left their posts and escaped. Most of those who had remained walked down the hallways with their hands held over their heads. They quickly filed out of the facility and slipped into the night, leaving the keys to the cells behind in their offices. Three of the jailers, however, were bent on toughing it out. One of them, the head of the torture crew, knew that there would be no escape for him. The citizens of Tehran would track him down when the news spread, and what they would do to him would be worse than death. As the CDCI rebels climbed up the stairway, they were met by a hail of automatic gunfire. 14 protesters dropped to the ground in a bloody heap. That is when the four bearded American Special Ops veterans shouted out their presence in the middle of the CDCI mob. Cannon announced, "We're Americans. We've come here to help your cause. Pull back. Go back down the stairs and we'll get you back upstairs again to save all of your friends in the jail." Jack and Cannon pushed their way through the retreating crowd until they were on the street level. Cannon pulled out two projectile guns with two anchor hooks attached to zip lines. He fired two up to the second-story windows. The hooks held. Cannon, the ex-ranger, tied the end of the zip lines around a street pole. Then he turned to Jack, his SEAL buddy. "I know you Navy guys like flopping around in the water, but you think you can handle a rope climb on land?" Jack grabbed one rope while Cannon wrapped his hands around the other. Jack gave a challenge. "On three, big guy. First one up to the window gets a free steak dinner, courtesy of the loser." Cannon nodded and smiled. One of their team members gave the count. One, two, three. The two warriors scampered up the ropes like monkeys. But Cannon got there first. They swung through the busted windows on the floor that housed the jail cells. They had landed in an empty file room. They quietly slipped to the doorway with their weapons ready. They could see the three armed jailers peeking over the railing at the top of the stairs, ready to shoot the next intruder. Jack gave the signal. Cannon would take the guy to the right, Jack would fire on the two on the left. Jack held up a finger on his left hand, then two fingers, then a third. They both fired a furious volley through the doorway and into the three jailers. One fell over the railing and down the stairwell. The other two crumpled where they stood.
"All clear," Cannon shouted out. "Come on up."
Then he searched the desks until he found the keys for all of the cells. On the first floor, as they ascended, the rebels saw the torture rooms splattered in blood. They climbed the stairs to the second floor and found Cannon and Jack waiting with the keys in their hands. Cannon handed them over to the CDCI rebels with a grin. They began to open the cells one by one. When they got to the second-to-last cell, they released Dr. Hermos Abdu, who cried out, then hugged them and pronounced a blessing over them. Then they yanked open Joshua Jordan's cell. Joshua struggled to his feet. Just then someone spoke in a voice that Joshua recognized as American.
"Sir, I'm a former Navy SEAL, and I've got a message for you," Jack said,
helping Joshua out of his cell.
"General Rocky Bridger says hello, and to tell you that it turns out your wife is an even better leader of the group than you ever were."
Joshua belly laughed and kept on laughing, despite the pain walking. Then another American stepped forward and said,
"Colonel Jordan, I'm Tom Cannonberry, but they call me Cannon, former Army Ranger. We're going to get you out of here."
Joshua turned and gestured toward Dr. Hermos Abdu.
"Men, this is Dr. Abdu, my friend. He's a marked man here in Iran. We need to take him with us."
But Dr. Abdu waved his hands and said,
"No, Joshua, you are very kind, but I am staying here. The people of Iran need to hear about the love of Christ. How can I leave such a great mission as that?"
Then Dr. Abdu turned and put his arm around another prisoner standing next to him, who was grinning through missing teeth. The man said in halting English,
"I follow Jesus now."
Joshua recognized the voice. He was the man who had said the same prayer as Joshua. Joshua smiled and gave him a nod. Then Joshua grabbed Dr. Abdu by the shoulders. There was so much he wanted to say but couldn't. Not now. No time. He could only blurt out, "God bless you, my friend." Dr. Hermos Abdu returned the benediction. "And may God bless you mightily, my brother." Then the four American Special Forces veterans surrounded Joshua like a group of linemen protecting a running back, and they started down the stairs. As they did, Cannon turned to Jack with a sly grin on his face. "I take my steak medium rare." New York City. Curtis Beltether, the shadowy web journalist and founder of Leakopedia, had been trying to track down Reverend Paul Campbell for weeks. He was aware that before the New Jersey blast, Campbell's widely publicized pronouncements of God's coming apocalypse had caused the media to sarcastically label him the Deacon of Doom. But now that a mini-apocalypse had actually occurred right across the bay from the media center of the universe in New York, Beltether noticed that the high potentates of the mainstream press weren't giving him the time of day, except for Amerinews, which had quoted Campbell a few times. Beltether loved this kind of intrigue. He had the notion that Campbell might have something interesting to say about a whole lot of things. But there was something else. The web reporter had been working a story about the United Nations Climate Convention and the newly formed Global Coalition of Religions that had become its public relations arm, trying to force new international environmental standards on every nation. Many of his fellow reporters had been tracking the climate revolution, but all from a sympathetic angle, about the need for global preparedness. But when the horrendous New Jersey nuke blast happened, that eclipsed everything in the news business, at least at first. The news coverage that had focused on the crumbling U.S. economy, the gas riots at the pump, the depression-like failure of the American agricultural heartland, the mall bombing, and then the shocking news of President Corlin's coma, now gave way to something even more stunning. The media launched into nonstop coverage of the nuclear devastation to the small town of Union Beach and the damage to its neighboring boroughs. Questions were asked about how it could have happened. Within hours after the tragedy, the innuendos started about a group of private vigilantes. Had they tried to interfere with the terrorists and recklessly caused the bomb to be detonated? Perhaps the federal authorities might have stopped the bomb before it arrived in New York had it not been for this lawless band of private mercenaries. But now, a week and a half later, some of the global warming spokespersons were speaking out about the effects of the nuclear detonations on the Earth's climate. They predicted that the radiation from the blasts in New Jersey and those in Iran would create a superheating of the atmosphere, beyond even that caused by the recent unexplained acceleration of average temperatures. But the more that Curtis Beltether dug, the more he sensed that the real story lay down at the murky, muddy bottom. During his interview with Dr. Robert Hamilton at the University of Hawaii, Hamilton had shown him his hard data on the climate effects of volcanic eruptions, the uptick in the number and the severity of global volcanic events which had spewed millions of tons of dust particles into the atmosphere, actually explained why suddenly global temperatures seemed to have spiked exponentially. Beltether was particularly interested in Hamilton's complaint that the federal climate agencies had blacklisted him and refused to consider his findings. If Hamilton's theory was right, the increase in temperatures was not a global warming crisis, but a short-lived trend caused by Mother Nature that would soon even out. As Beltether kept digging, he saw a fascinating phenomenon unfolding before his eyes. An international movement was capitalizing on the climate crisis in ways that might change life on Earth in radical ways. Beltether was now a dog on a bone, and he would not be sidetracked. When the Union Beach nuclear disaster occurred, Beltether figured that it would take a miracle to get Pastor Campbell to sit down for an interview. The pastor was working around the clock in the neighborhoods near his Manhattan-based Eternity Church to help those who had been impacted by the blast, setting up soup kitchens, locating missing persons, establishing a homeless shelter in his church. The radiation findings, so far for New York City, were fairly good news. The strong wind blew most of the radiation out to sea, but Wall Street and the stock market had been shut down and was still frozen in trading status since the blast. The real fear that nobody wanted to talk about because of the grotesque loss of life in the New Jersey attack, 8,000 dead, not counting those injured, perhaps critically, was the impending collapse of the American economy. The United States government had cordoned off most of the New Jersey shoreline surrounding the pitiful ashen ruins of what had formerly been Union Beach. The FBI was performing an all-out investigation to trace the groups behind the attack. Secretly, however, they had discovered Jim Yanicki's connection to the disaster and took him into custody. The U.S. Attorney General's office was personally conducting the interrogation. The government was quickly starting to mount a criminal case against the Roundtable and Abigail Jordan in particular for acts of vigilantism, acts, according to the Department of Justice, that had actually provoked the nuclear detonation during their botched citizens' attempt to stop it. Jessica Tallroot, meanwhile, had finally been sworn in as President of the United States as Virgil Corland continued to languish in a coma. Her strategy had been to keep delaying the formal swearing-in until the optimal political timing. Her instincts proved to be spot-on once again. It just so happened that now she could officially assume executive power after the New Jersey attack. That way, Corland would be blamed, and she could avoid political responsibility for that horrible assault on American shores. She immediately ordered the Attorney General to forcefully prosecute any renegade citizens who might have taken the law into their own hands. By that, of course, she meant the Roundtable, Abigail Jordan, and especially Joshua. On a hunch, Beltether painstakingly worked his way through the crush of traffic, police checkpoints, and emergency radiation huts around New York City. Finally, he showed up at Eternity Church. He figured that would be a good place to start. Hundreds of people, church staff, the homeless, and volunteers were milling around. No one seemed to know where Pastor Campbell was. One elderly black woman heard Beltether inquiring about Campbell and piped up. "You leave him alone," she said. "He's taking a nap down in the church kitchen. Let the man catch some sleep." And with that, Beltether immediately charged down the stairs to the busy church basement, where meals were being handed out to several hundred people. He nosed around until he came to a storage room. He cracked open the door. There, curled up on the floor and snoring, was Pastor Campbell. "Sorry to bother you," the reporter announced, even though he really wasn't sorry, and kept nudging the minister until his eyes opened. "Pastor Campbell, I'm Curtis Beltether, the web commentator. I'm doing an exposé on the Global Coalition of Religions and the International Climate Movement."
"Beltether?" he replied, bleary-eyed. "Oh, yes. I remember."
Campbell slowly rose to his feet and dusted off his wrinkled pants and open shirt. "You're going to have to follow me while we talk. I can't sit around for an interview. Too much to do." "Okay with me. So, first question. The New Jersey bombing. 8,000 massacred. The missile strike on Israel and the nuclear detonations in Iran. Isn't this starting to look a lot like Armageddon to you?"
"Armageddon," Campbell said, as he patted a few volunteers on the back as he walked past. "Hardly. What you're seeing right now are simply shadows of things to come.
How can you tell?"
"Israel will be attacked. Already happened. Come on, I'm sure you've read the news."
"No, you don't understand, Mr. Beltether. The Bible has already told us precisely what is about to occur. Iran's missile attack against Israel was not it. No. The Bible tells us explicitly about a coming war against Israel. The real thing hasn't started yet. But I do read the news, Mr. Beltether, and I believe we will be seeing the beginning of the end unfolding very soon."
Campbell was a fast walker, so much so that Beltether was having a hard time keeping up as they made their way across the church basement, up the stairs, and through the sanctuary.
A young Asian man interrupted them to give Campbell a quick report on the church's project to help the New Jersey families impacted by the blast. When he left, Campbell smiled as he pointed to him.
"See the young guy there? He stopped by one day to listen to a press conference I was holding here at the church. He never left."
Then Campbell turned to Beltether and put his hands on both of his shoulders.
"Listen to me carefully. The Bible tells us that the war against Israel will be a defining moment that marks the end of the age. the beginning of the last chapter of life on earth as we have known it. Then it also tells us who it is will be waging war against Israel, and even something beyond that.
Campbell's index finger was pointing straight up in the air. His face was illuminated by some interior flame.
Mr. Beltether, the Bible tells us exactly how God is going to miraculously intervene. It explains very plainly how he is going to do it. And when God intervenes, when that happens, I guarantee you, my friend, it is going to be a wonder to behold.
Beltether wasn't going to let it rest there. Sure, he considered Campbell and his fundamentalist prophecy cronies to be crackpots, but he did believe that the real-life formation of a United Nations-backed world religious coalition, one that in lightning speed had gained the support of the most powerful nations on Earth, well, that was something surprising even to him. And in the background, as Beltether was beginning to realize, a few interesting personalities were pulling the strings. He knew that to get Campbell's take on all that, he would have to endure the pastor's ramblings about the end of the world. So he asked the question that even a cub reporter would ask, the billion-dollar question. Tell me, Reverend Campbell, who's going to invade Israel? And exactly what is God planning to do about it? I'd like to hear.
Campbell swung open the front doors of the church. The daylight poured in, and he stepped outside. The pastor turned and said to Beltether, "Anyone who really wants to know had better have ears to hear."
"Hear what?" Pastor Campbell answered with only two words.
Beltether had no idea what they meant, at least not then. The two words were, "Ezekiel's thunder."
Part 3. The Coming Thunder. With Moscow's coffers replenished by the global oil boom, Admiral Vladimir Masorin, Russia's naval commander, has announced ambitious plans to expand the country's primary Black Sea base and establish a permanent presence in the eastern Mediterranean for the first time since the Cold War. Washington Times, August 7, 2007. Russian Federation Navy Group's frigate, Ladny, and deep-sea tug, Shakhter, will make stops at the naval base of Taranto from 5 to 8, and Augusta from 13 to 15 September. The presence of the naval group in the Mediterranean, belonging to the Black Sea Fleet, is part of the development of international cooperation between the Italian Navy and the Russian Federation. World Aeronautical Press Agency, September 2, 2010. A Russian flag in the center of Jerusalem, in such close proximity to the Holy Sepulchre, is priceless. Sergei Stepashin, former Russian Prime Minister and Security Police General. Chapter 56. In the Situation Room of the White House, Secretary of Defense Roland Allenworth was using a red dot laser pointer. He was aiming it at a digital wall map of the world, sending the iridescent dot to several points throughout Russia, over to its neighboring republics, across the Mediterranean, to points in the Middle East, and then to northern Africa. President Tolerud had planned on devoting the majority of the National Security meeting to the nuclear attacks on U.S. soil, both the New Jersey massacre and the foiled attempt in Virginia. She had a plan and a political solution she wanted to float once again as a cure for these terror attacks. If she could get her national security staff behind it, she could roll it out for America, and she would be viewed as its champion-in-chief. Now, Allenworth's report about this Russian thing was a distraction. Her tone was clipped. "So what's the conclusion, Secretary Allenworth?"
"Madam President, we're not sure yet. We are trying to locate a pattern to these large troop movements of Russia and its federation, as well as some of the Islamic nations. It's a complicated picture. There are intense naval movements as well. We're looking for some logical symmetry to them. Our agents are picking up Russian communiques that indicate this is just a coordinated set of war games, but the question is whether they're giving us a false lead."
"So, you have nothing definitive? Fine. Then keep us apprised."
Admiral William Patch, the National Security Advisor to former President Courland, raised a finger to speak. Tolerud didn't care for him, and she knew that the buzzer was about to sound on Patch's tenure now that Courland was out of the picture. And Patch knew it as well.
I think, Patch said, that the Secretary's warnings are not just theoretical. This could be a major military engagement, possibly to expand the Russian Federation, maybe as a counterpunch against Israel now that it has fended off Iran's attack. But the Secretary of State threw a disgusted look at Patch. What would Russia possibly have to gain by that? Russia would have to be concerned about our reaction to a military offensive like that. Besides, thanks to Madam President's deft diplomacy, our relations with Russia are superb. They've increased oil allotments to the U.S. It's all good. President Tullrud broke in.
Admiral Patch, our ambassador told me just yesterday that he believes Russia was probably going to flex its muscles in that region just to keep Israel and Iran from escalating an already nightmarish nuclear exchange that has occurred between those nations. Frankly, having Russia play policeman in that region is fine with me. The United States has enough problems of our own. We don't need to do that job. In fact, right after the Natanz and Bushehr attacks, didn't the EU Parliament even call for Russia to play, what was the wording? I think it was something like the firmest possible security role to ensure peace in the Mediterranean. Along those lines, am I right, people? This isn't unusual. Russia's been playing an increasing naval role in the Mediterranean over the last decade. Furthermore, 2 days ago, as a gesture of goodwill, the Russian Prime Minister pledged $500 million in Russian aid to help rebuild the New Jersey area and outlying areas. Does that sound like a country that wants to offend us?
No, Secretary of Defense Allenworth replied with a smooth-as-glass calm in his voice. That sounds like a country who wants to bribe us.
Tullrud exploded with a loud caterwaul.
Don't be ridiculous!
Admiral Patch started to speak, but Tullrud cut him off.
You people would be the first to criticize me if I ignored American interests in favor of some tiny nation in the Middle East. But here I am, saying that America has suffered a nuclear attack. So let's look to our own interests and not waste our time on some tiny nation in the Middle East.
By that, Admiral Patch said, you're referring to Israel, America's long-standing ally in a hostile area of the world.
Wake up, Admiral, Tullrud snapped. We have other allies. Arab allies, Russian allies, global allies. United Nations as an ally. Check your calendar. This isn't the 1950s.
The room fell quiet. Tullrud said,
Now for a very timely matter.
I'm happy to report that Congress is getting close to being able to pass my key proposal, the National Security Through Identification Act. And I want you all on board with this.
Helen Brokstead, the Director of Homeland Security, jumped in.
This legislation is brilliant. It mandates a biological identification tag imprint on the body of every American citizen, the BID tag. Madam President, you have extolled its virtues before, in this very room, as a matter of fact, when you were Vice President. The BID tag would have stopped those nuclear murderers who set off the bomb in Union Beach and the terror cell in Shenandoah. And the Mall of America bombing, as well as the Chicago air disaster. We could have identified each of them when they passed through the airports and train stations and public buildings, because they wouldn't have had their BID tag imprints. Or if they did, then their backgrounds, criminal records, associations, all of it would have instantly shown up on our screens. This is an idea, Madam President, whose time has truly come.
Tullrud basked in the accolade.
I really do believe this is going to revolutionize national security. By imprinting every lawful American citizen with a tiny laser tattoo invisible to the eye, painless, that contains all of their biological and personal identification data, criminal record, international travel data, we can screen them, and then we can instantly weed out the bad eggs from the good. After all, people do that when they go grocery shopping, don't they?
A few of her advisers laughed and nodded. Admiral Patch wasn't one of them. Tullrud put a finer, much more somber point on it.
8,000 Americans dead, ladies and gentlemen, in New Jersey. And the number is growing. Our citizens want some assurance of safety. And I am the president who is about to give it to them.
At Hawk's Nest, Abigail was finishing up a phone call with Harry Smythe, her attorney.
Any more news about Josh? Harry asked.
No, not since the last call from Rocky Bridger, when he confirmed that Josh had been rescued and was out of Iran, thank the Lord.
Abby, I'm so sorry all of this is falling down on your head.
I'm trying to focus on the positive.
Josh is safe. Deborah is okay. I talked to her. She's tucked away in a friendly condo outside of Jerusalem. We're working on getting her out of Israel. But, well, Deb is just like her dad, strong-willed. She's refusing to leave without her father. I guess I can't blame her.
Well, I'll let you know, Harry said, wrapping up the reason for the call. The minute I find out anything about a criminal indictment against you on your involvement in the nuclear incident in New Jersey. Right now, it's hard to know where this thing is going.
Abigail's voice cracked. All those thousands of people, innocent people in that little town, killed. And I can't shake the feeling that I'm the one responsible. Harry, the nightmares I have, every night, night after night.
Harry got tough. Look, Abby, two things are true. First, terrorists drove that bomb into New Jersey, not you. Get that straight in your head. If Josh were here, he'd say the same thing. Brave men tried to stop it. You gave the order, but they volunteered. And brave men died trying. And it looks like the nuke would have gotten into the heart of New York City had it not been for you. And second, where was our government? Why does it take a semi-retired lawyer in her log cabin in the Rockies to try to stop a nuclear attack?
Harry's tone softened just a little.
Abby, you're putting up a brave front, but I can hear the anguish underneath. But then the quintessential Harry Smythe came out. The I told you so, coming from an attorney who never liked the idea of the round table in the first place. I just want you to recall, Abby, that you told me yourself that you knew the legal risks. You knew the round table could be prosecuted by a hostile, motivated Department of Justice. Now it's come home to roost.
She didn't like to hear that, but Harry was right. After she hung up, she noticed that Cal had slipped out onto the porch and was standing next to her.
Any news?
No, Abby said. Harry's waiting to see if the grand jury's going to issue an indictment against me and the round table.
You're a hero, Mom. So is Dad. But I guess that doesn't mean anything.
But Abigail didn't feel like a hero. She had blood on her hands, and the weight of that thought was almost too much to bear.
We do everything we can do, even when it ends in terrible disaster. Then all we can do is stand and wait on the Lord, no matter how difficult.
She had to choke back tears. Cal put his hand on his mother's shoulder and squeezed it.
Any news about Dad?
She regained her composure.
Nothing new. Cal, where in the world is Josh right now? Where?
The southern tip of Azerbaijan. Joshua and the four-man rescue team were exhausted. Cannon looked through his binoculars and nodded.
That looks like a city up ahead. Must be Lerik, the secondary pickup point.
After driving out of Tehran and back north to the Iranian coast, the rescue team and Joshua waited for the Israeli chopper to appear at the rendezvous point near Nekka. But the Israelis didn't show. Somehow the team wasn't surprised. Israel had other problems on his hands. As a result, the five men had to scramble. They had to swipe a powerboat and cross the Caspian Sea toward Azerbaijan. They fully expected the worst, namely to meet up with Iranian patrol boats en route and then have to fight their way through. But for some reason, the Iranian Coast Guard never appeared. All they could figure was that something big must have happened, some change in Iranian military strategy regarding its coastline. Just short of the border, they dumped the boat and walked inland, relieved that at least they were close to leaving Iran. They waited until nightfall to cross into Azerbaijan, then walked past the town of Astara and 30 miles north to Lerik. Jack pulled out his GPS and secured the coordinates. They were now only a few miles from the pickup point, but they weren't expecting an Israeli helicopter this time. The Israelis had summoned help from the Republic of Georgia, which lay to the north of Azerbaijan. Georgia had resisted an alliance with Russia and had secretly coordinated defenses with Israel. But as a former part of the Soviet Union, it retained mutual contacts with the Russian republics. So it was decided by Rocky Bridger and the IDF headquarters that a civilian commercial helicopter from Georgia was likely to raise few eyebrows if it was seen over Azerbaijan airspace. Georgia agreed to the plan and sent a two-pilot helicopter to the new pickup point. The team looked at their watches. Cannon said, "We have 6 hours until pickup. Let's find a safe place to crash for a couple of hours." They found a spot just off the main road.
They settled at the edge of a thick forest of trees. Cannon pointed out that the trees were called Demir Agash, the famous iron tree with its orange leaves and fruit. A few of the guys picked some of the fruit off the branches. That was enough, together with the cooler full of food on the boat they had stolen, to help ease their nagging hunger for a while. From their position they could see the road below. Cars passed. A convertible filled with several dark-haired, attractive girls passed. And the two younger special ops guys, both of whom were single, cracked jokes. But Joshua couldn't help thinking about Abigail, wondering if she'd been told about his rescue. Surely she had. He had left her behind with so many burdens, and he thought about Cal, and was glad that he was there with Abby. Joshua was certain that Cal would step up to the plate and be the man of the house in his absence. And Joshua wondered about his country. As he lay on the mossy forest floor, he was feeling his age, as well as the effects of the beatings he had received in captivity. But one thought overshadowed even his bone-sickening fatigue and pain. He wished he could simply will the message across to the other side of the planet. "Abby, please know how much I love you, baby. I'm coming home." Then he was struck with a thought, and he put it into silent words. "God, please let Abby know I'm all right. Keep her safe. Deb and Cal, too. Thanks for listening. Amen." Down on the road, a few people on horses clip-clopped past. Then it was quiet for more than an hour. Joshua, in his exhaustion, drifted off into a deep, otherworldly sleep. The quiet was broken, however, with the rumbling of a military convoy that echoed up to the forests. Armored Humvees, tanks, troop transports, missile launchers, all rolling down the road. The team members sat up, fast and rigid, like pointer dogs. Jack was the only one to speak. "Something's about to break loose." Chapter 57. On the Mediterranean Sea. The Russian general had just given the order. "The invasion of Israel and the destruction of the Jewish occupiers shall commence in 12 hours. Vice Admiral Sergei Trishnipov was enjoying the excellent vantage point from the bridge on the destroyer Kiev. He had a nearly 300-degree view of the massive flotilla he was commanding. It had taken years for Russia to rebuild its sagging navy. Now, at last, he would show the world that Russia ruled the seas. Most of the American press had readily accepted the explanation that this was nothing more than a joint naval exercise. So when NATO member states protested, Russia and its allies didn't care. Without backing from the U.S., Europe was likely to do nothing, particularly because there was little love for the tiny nation that the Russian Islamic coalition would be soon invading. Whatever sympathy existed for Israel had now disappeared after its preemptive strike against Iran, which was followed by the RTS-guided nuking of Bushehr. The Russian Islamic coalition was ready to make its defense to the world. After all, hadn't an American-led coalition attacked Iraq over its invasion of Kuwait decades before? So why shouldn't a Russian-led coalition of Middle Eastern nations invade Israel over its military aggression against Iran? Russia's long-standing partnership with Syria and its use of the Syrian port of Tartus gave it an ideal launching platform for the naval phase of the invasion. Trishnipov, who had helped shape the naval operation of the war, liked the plan. 4 Russian aircraft carriers from his fleet would launch 400 MiG fighter jets and bombers over Israeli airspace and pound Israeli defenses. 7 transport ships, carrying 300,000 soldiers from the Russian Islamic Alliance, would land simultaneously at Haifa and Tel Aviv. That was twice the size of Israel's entire standing army. Then a dozen submarines and 10 heavily armed patrol boats would seal off Israel's coast. At the same time, the coalition army would begin the land invasion from the north, advancing through Syria and pouring down into Israel. That force consisted of 500,000 troops from Russia, Turkey, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, as well as other Russian republics. From the south, another 50,000 troops would blast their way into Israel from the armies of Libya and the Sudan. Syria, Egypt, and Jordan would tell the world they had no choice but to permit the invading armies to cross their lands en route to Israel, or else suffer annihilation themselves. but they would privately celebrate the anticipated decimation of the nation of Israel, that thorn in the side of Islam. Trishnipov gazed through the window. It was a clear, mild day. He wished he was on the deck catching the fresh air, instead of locked inside the glass-enclosed bridge. But this is where he needed to be, in full control of the naval invasion.